Okay, now it is my privilege to introduce, I think Bill said it best, one of our own, right? You know, when you get commitments in any group, you know, I have a few in this group and other groups, you know, and you kind of form a bond with those people. There are the secretary, treasury, and ship person, and all of that. So that's what, you know, it's happened with me and Ryan, you know, and Phil and Alyssa. We've been doing this since May last year. So it is really, I'm very proud to introduce to you guys tonight's speaker. It is our, like I said, it's one of our own, Ryan, with 6 years from Kingsburg. So please, please give him a warm applause.
And for the third time, I'm Ryan. I'm an alcoholic. It was a little difficult for me to finally own the fact that I live in Kingsburg now. I have some of my friends here from Fresno, so I've officially made that statement that I do not longer live in Fresno, but I'm Kingsburgian. I guess is how you would say that. You know, it's been an absolute pleasure to be a part of this group and have, you know, a couple different service positions here. I spoke here September of 2013, and I've been coming to this group ever since. Prior to that, a lot of the faces here, a lot of the people that I met here at this group, you know, I had never seen before. But, you know, it's been an absolute pleasure to say that a lot of you guys are, I consider you part of my, you know, part of my family. I love this group, even though I don't get to share a lot of the time other than the treasury report that doesn't share much about, you know, my experience or why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's a lot of new people, and, you know, when I see the different homes that are here, the, you know, whether you guys are coming, you got into the homes from Joe or whatever the case is for you, I relate. I remember being in that position, thinking that everything was going to be okay and that I wasn't really in a dangerous position and that if I just did the best that I could in sobriety, that everything would work out. And going to four different rehabs, I also learned that it wasn't as easy as I expected it to be. Sobriety for an alcoholic and a drug addict like I am requires a very serious surrender, a surrender that I had no concept of. And so I definitely want to take the next 40 minutes or so to share with you guys a little bit about my experience. As I said, I grew up in Fresno, and, you know, growing up there, in my immediate family, there wasn't any serious alcohol or drug problems around me, so I didn't really learn it from anybody else. What I do remember was when my parents got divorced when I was 4 years old, I remember thinking that it was my fault and that I had something to do with that. And at 4 years old, I pretty much carried that kind of perception and those ideas with me. And as I got older, I started getting more experience. And whenever you you live life with a perception like that, whatever happens, you're seeing it through those lenses, so to speak. Thank you. And so no matter what happened, I kept thinking, there's something wrong with me. And as I got older, those beliefs got stronger. And from those beliefs stemmed more, you know, kind of blossomed other beliefs that were along the same line. And what it looked like for me is, no matter how good I did, it wasn't enough. Right? And when I was 16 years old, or about 15 years old, my desire to fit in and really my motivation to fit in became stronger, you know, especially as I became more and more interested in women and being popular in school. So I did, it started off pretty innocent for me where I would, you know, I thought, hey, this is a good idea to fit in. And so I'd wait for my mom to go to sleep and I'd steal her BMW and go pick up my friends and we'd go drive around in the BMW. It was innocent. So I thought, it's pretty stupid, but I never got caught. In fact, I told my mom about it, which I had done it a lot of different times. I told my mom in rehab, you know, they get into rehab and they say, you got to be honest. That's when I first started hearing about this complete honesty thing, or this rigorous honesty. So I told my mom in rehab. But I was 15 years old, and in Fresno, I had a run-in where there was five of us in the car. I was driving, and over in River Park, if you guys know where that's at, they had just got done with the DUI checkpoint, so they were tearing it all down, but there was a bunch of cop cars, and I'm a 15-year-old kid not having any understanding of what that is. So I freaked out, and I just kept going, and the next thing you know, I have three cop cars chasing us. And I get to Fresno and Nice, and the light's red. I'm not going to stop, so I ran it. And we got chased into one of the neighborhoods. I was able to get enough distance ahead of him where he turned a corner. I saw a car parked in the driveway and parked on the other side of it, turned the car off, never got caught. Right? So from an early age, I mean, I was doing pretty, you know, it started off innocent, pretty stupid stuff. It took a while for me to start getting caught, but I got away with a lot of things, which I'm sure a lot of us can understand. Shortly after that, my mom was looking for houses up in Sacramento. We were getting ready to move, and I started, you know, would throw parties. And it was the first time that I didn't really understand drinking. I didn't have any concept of it, really. My mom had a bar at the house, so I saw alcohol, but I didn't tie this thought of feeling not good enough and alcohol. I didn't see the connection. But when I drank the first party, at the first party, I blacked out. Passed out. The door, you know, the front door was left open. My dogs got out. My neighbor had to come and get me because of the neighborhood that we lived in. Some of the houses looked the same. So my dogs were over at his house barking at like 6 in the morning, waking him up, him and the family up. So he brought the dogs back. So that was the first time that I experienced that. I mean, from the very first time I experienced a blackout. I got in trouble because there was a lot of damage in the house and I couldn't cover it up. And it got in trouble. I was the type of kid where my mom would, you know, threaten and say, you're on, you know, grounded. And within a couple days, I found a way to get out of it. Like 3 weeks later, my mom went back to Sacramento again, left me at the house. I did the exact same thing, threw a party. I was innocent, though. When we moved to Sacramento, that was a big change for me. At first, I thought it was going to be a great idea, a new life. You know, maybe I had all these ideas of what it would look like, almost like from a movie. You know, I'd go in and I just immediately fit in. And moved to Sacramento, and it was completely different. I experienced loneliness, and for the first time, I was in the cafeteria for a little while, sitting by myself. And the first two people to befriend me were, you know, what I would, they're not exactly the type of people I would normally hang out with, but, you know, they're my friends. I got an opportunity after about 8 months, which took forever to start getting the opportunity to fit in with the crowd that I wanted to be a part of, and I got invited to a party. At the party, there was a lot of different types of alcohol, and that's when I first started hearing from kids in high school, you know, don't mix alcohol, don't do hard liquor, don't do beer, don't mix champagne. There was champagne, hard alcohol. We had beer, wine. You know, when you're 16 years old, you just drink whatever you can get. And so I immediately started drinking, and I just continued to drink until I was blacked out. And my friends tried to take me back to my house, and of course, as they're driving me back in my mom's car, that same BMW that I would steal, I was trying to jump out the back door because I just wanted to go back to the party. I wasn't done yet. And with the help of my brother, they got me into my room. As they took off, my brother was pulling the car back into the garage, and I jumped through my window. And as my brother's getting ready to pull the car in the garage, I'm running down the street with my socks. And I have no shoes. My socks are halfway off. Flopping as I'm running down the road laughing. My whole point was I was going back to that party. So I'm on my way back to the party. I guess one of my friends that was throwing the party, it was his first opportunity to have sex with a girl. And he was upstairs in his room with a girl, and I ran into that bathroom. Well, I somehow happened to crap myself on the way to the party. I think if I was to do that now, I probably wouldn't go to the party. So I got the call in the morning, him saying, "Hey, Ryan, do you know what happened last night?" And I go, "Yeah, dude, you guys dropped me off," and that was it. But vaguely I sensed that that wasn't true. He says, "Dude, you owe my sister a lot of money for all the damage. I guess I had ruined, like, I ruined the shower curtain and towels, and it was a bad deal." So, as funny as that is, I still find humor in it. That's pretty hard when you're a 16-year-old kid trying to fit in and you have this idea of there's something wrong with me, right? And so, of course, I set on a different, another mission of I'm going to overcome that. I'm going to prove that I am good enough to myself and to other people. Because of sports, it was easy for me to continue to be a part, you know, go to the parties and other things like that. But as much as this is Alcoholics Anonymous, I will share a little bit of my experience because I am both an alcoholic and a drug addict. I will share in a very general way about drugs, but I was in high school and I've shared this as well. I had a Spanish class. It was my second period Spanish class and I hated it. My study skills were horrible. I didn't like to study. So all my other classes, all the way through high school, I could get A's and D's without studying. I'd just do the homework, I'd, you know, show up and I'd pass the test. But Spanish, you can't do that if you don't speak Spanish. I wasn't willing to adjust, apply more discipline and study for my Spanish class. So that created more anxiety of going into that class. And so I had this Spanish, and after first period, one of my friends, she says, "Hey, Ryan, my dad doesn't need this pain medication anymore. Do you want to take it?" And I didn't know anything about it. I was very innocent, and I took it with no curiosity or hesitation of maybe I shouldn't take it. I just took it. Next thing you know, I'm in this Spanish class, and that fear I had, feeling like the teacher was picking on me and that I was going to get caught for not studying or anything like that, all of a sudden that my whole feeling and outlook changed. All of a sudden I felt like I fit in, and it appeared to me like I could speak Spanish. Obviously that wasn't the case. I didn't speak Spanish, but my perception changed. And as much as I didn't know what that medication was going to do for me, I knew at that point that what I had taken, something that I had taken, had changed the way that I felt and the way that I thought about myself and the way that I saw you. Now all of a sudden in that class I'm not threatened. And thought of there's something wrong with me and everything else that comes from that went away. There's a part in our book where it talks about this essential psychic change that has to take place. That's what, I'll get a little bit more in depth with it, but that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, is getting you connected to a power greater than yourself that can create a psychic change like alcohol and drugs do for us before sobriety. You know, if you don't have that experience, then it's going to seem like it's not possible. There's no way that God can really do what alcohol and drugs did for me. But all our program asks is for a willingness just to consider, is it possible? If you're at a place right now where you're like, "No, it's not possible," we'll continue to drink and use drugs, and maybe you'll get put in a place where circumstances will make you willing to consider it. But that's my experience, is that this program has created that psychic change that has been sufficient for a little over 6 years now. So that was my first experience. From that moment was a domino effect. And I just found myself on run after run after run after run. Didn't matter if I ended up in jail. You know, shortly after that, I was on another run, hitting another bottom, bottom after bottom after bottom. And as young as I am, you know, a lot of people will maybe, and I hear it from people, they're like, "Oh, I drank more than you did, or I spilt more than you drank." From the outside, a lot of people will have the perception, but with what I went through, it was just an onslaught. There wasn't a natural or a slow progression for me. It was quick. And, from that time, I'm 18 years old. Fast forward, I'm 18 years old, and I get arrested for a possession charge, a felony possession charge, and I end up in jail in Sacramento. I'm in jail, and all I'm thinking is, God, help me with this. Please give me the willingness to not want to drink, right? I knew that I needed to stop, and I wanted to want to stop, right? My whole drinking and using was characterized by me being on the fence. I couldn't ever decide what side of the fence I was on, right? The book talks about, it gives a description of the alcoholic. It talks about their emotional psychopath. They're over remorseful. They make many resolutions, but never a decision. Right? I'll get sober if, as long as this doesn't happen. I had a lot of that going on. And within a week after getting out of jail, knowing that I had, some trouble over my head, I was back doing the same thing that I was doing before, but it progressed. Like most times you get in trouble, 6 months later I finally see the judge, and in between, there's a lot of things that have happened before, but I don't have enough time to go into detail. So I had gotten a scholarship for soccer. With all this insanity going on, I still was able to get a scholarship for soccer. So after getting arrested, I'm trying, my family and my friends and my coaches are saying, stay out of trouble so you can still get this scholarship. Well, that would make sense if I had control over what I did. A few months later, I was at a party at my house, and I drank a bottle, probably close to a bottle of vodka, and I drove. I'm the type of drinker where I drink and I don't stay in one place. I drink and I want to go somewhere. So you would very rarely ever find anybody driving me while I was drinking. And so I remember being in Sacramento, getting on the freeway, and this is during a blackout. I remember little glimpses. I remember getting on the freeway, hitting the guardrail as I'm getting on the freeway, laughing. Right? Things have progressed a little bit since I was still in my mom's car. The next thing you know, at 6 in the morning, I'm getting woken up by the cops. I was in Oak Park, which is not a good area in Sacramento. They woke me up. I had passed out. There's this dead-end road in this neighborhood. The cops had woken me up. Somehow I got my truck turned around, but I passed out in my truck with it in drive in the neighborhood. But because I was dead weight, my foot stayed on the brake, and my truck ran out of gas. So they woke me up, right? 6 in the morning. They see my scholarship papers are in the back of my truck, and they said, after I came to, they said, if you can get your mom here in 30 minutes, we'll release you to her. I mean, that's one of the instances where I sidestepped, or I avoided a lot more trouble, because I already had a felony. I'm like 18 years old doing this. That could have been a lot more trouble. You think I would learn? My truck was totaled from probably hitting the guardrail and who knows what else. And I went home, woke up, tried to come to, figure out what was going on. I called my mom and asked her what was going on. She continued to explain. A few months later, I finally go and see this judge. They tell me what I have to do. They give me these steps I have to take to get everything off my record. And even the drug tests that they were giving me, alcohol and drug tests, I still couldn't. I could not, even with that program, with all that pressure over my head, with, the threat of going to jail or prison, losing my scholarship, so on and so forth, I still continue to try to work the system, so to speak. And that was my thought process. How can I, these are the rules, but how can I avoid it? Like it says in How It Works, try to find an easier, softer way. And so they tell me what to do. Well, several months later, I'm doing a lot of different things, a lot of drinking, a lot of drug using. And I had woken up after a long run, and I was at my mom's house. My mom says, I want you to go back to your place. This house, my mom was renting a room for me. with a bunch of college guys, and she wanted me to go back home, and I didn't want to. And she says, "You need to go. You need to go." And I told her, made this threat. And during this period of time, I think I had made this threat a couple times. I vaguely remember, but I told her, "If you make me go, I'll kill myself." Right? It's very self-centered, very selfish thing to say to your mom. When my brother then came out of his room and he says, "Ryan, why do you keep doing this to yourself?" And when he said that, for some reason that just hit me. There was something about, as much as I hated that statement, there was truth to that. I just couldn't stand what was taking place, why I was doing this to myself. So I took off. I'm driving, and I was in Elk Grove, and just thinking about, how am I going to kill myself? And I see these street lights. I'm like, I could just drive my truck into the streetlight. It was just a real, passing thought. I'm like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to turn around. I'm going to go home. Get to this light. It's a red light. And all of a sudden, this overwhelming feeling came to me. Like, I didn't want to continue to do what I was doing, but I didn't want to be sober either. I didn't want to live. And so this feeling, it was this very strong, dark feeling came over me. And I turned the truck around once the light turned green, and I just floored it. And I drove the truck into a street light at 65 miles an hour. The street light came all the way. It was one of the tall, really tall street lights. Came through the motor, cracked the motor. Airbags didn't go off. Next thing you know, I'm waking up in the hospital. All I suffered was a concussion. And so I'm in the hospital, and after some time, they say, "You're going to go to a psych ward. It's 5150. Right? I'm like, they're like, 72 hours. I'm like, are you kidding me? I've only been in jail for 24 hours. I can't do 72 hours. And so while I'm in the psych ward with people I don't think I, belong with, my mom comes to me and she says, "You're going to rehab." And it never even crossed my mind that I needed to stop. My thought process, other than the fact that I wanted to kill myself, once I was in the hospital and they're giving me good medication, I'm kind of starting to feel better. My thought process was, I just need to manage it better next time. I was automatically thinking about how I could do it differently. And so I went to rehab. I went to a rehab in Phoenix, a Christian rehab center. Went there, and it was the first time that I really felt like I wanted to be sober. I always grew up around church, so I knew that it was what I was doing wasn't God's will. And so I did everything that they told me. I participated like they told me to participate. I was a model patient. And like most rehabs, they say, when you get out, get a sponsor, 90 meetings in 90 days, work the steps, all of that. And I thought, if I was just sincere enough and I did everything that they told me to do, that I would gain momentum, so to speak, and that this would be easy. And so got out, followed everything that they said, I started working the steps, got to the eighth step, and I relapsed. Right? That first rehab I went to was December of 2005. Now, July of 2006, I was back in that, my mom sent me to that rehab again. They were surprised that I was even in there. "What? Why are you in here? You did everything we thought you would succeed. I can't believe, why are you here?" Same thing. I had a little bit of shame, feeling bad about it, and I'm like, I'm going to try harder. So, get out of the rehab. Go back to me, start working with my sponsor, relapse. Right? And every time I relapsed, I wasn't relapsing for like a week. I was staying out there until I was physically removed from alcohol or drugs. It usually was, running with the cops. And so this proceeded. I've been through four rehabs. So this is my fifth time sober. Every time I went out there, it got worse. It progressively got worse, like a lot of people say in meetings. The last time that I was sober is what I want to spend a little bit more time on, because I didn't get to spend that much time on it last time I spoke. So this fourth time that I'm sober, I've at this point gone, there's a lot of, if you notice in AA, if you're around enough, there's a lot of different types of sponsorship. You know, just because we're in Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't mean that there's just one way of working the steps. You'll hear a lot of different beliefs and experiences and opinions on how to work the steps. And at this point, every time I got sober, I was completely sincere about wanting to be sober. And so I would try, after going through that first sponsor, I'd try another sponsor and then try another sponsor because I didn't think anything was working, right? I'm conflicted throughout this entire process, though. Part of me is resentful at you because what you say isn't working, but then I still have that same belief that something's wrong with me, not really knowing what the difference is, right? So I get a different sponsor, a type of sponsor that's just directly from the book, and there was a disconnect there, and I remember I was getting ready to do the third step, and there was this guy, this was in Clovis, and he's kind of just eavesdropping, and he goes, right when I'm getting ready to do the third step with a sponsor, and he says, hold on. He says, Ryan, do you know what turning your will in your life means? He says, do you know what your will in your life is? And I just kind of guessed, right? My whole sobriety, I just kind of guessed what powerlessness meant, or I guessed what unmanageability meant, so on and so forth. And he says, you turn your will in your life, your will is your thinking, and your life is your action. That's what he said, right? And it kind of just made me think. He says, instead of just turning your will over right now, why don't you go home and think about it? What I had discovered after talking with him a little bit more, that sponsor I had, I didn't feel comfortable. I told him, I don't want to work with you. And so I continued to talk with this guy that kind of butted in. And this is what I had discovered. Anybody that's new or that's a retread, I seriously urge you to think about if this is your experience or if this is occasionally a thought. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, right, because I felt comfortable here. And I would say I'm an alcoholic because you're supposed to, right? I didn't want to be the person not saying I'm an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to fit in. But 3-4 months into sobriety, I would start questioning myself of if I'm really an alcoholic or not, right? When those kind of doubts start creeping in, it's so much more difficult to identify and follow this program of action, right? If I can't identify with you, if I'm not unified with you, it's very difficult for me to trust what you're saying or what even this big book is saying, right? And what I was constantly thinking is, okay, well, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, right? Because I see so much drugs in my experience. I can accept I'm a drug addict, but that makes me different than you. Maybe my anxiety and my depression, it's because of anxiety and depression. There's a chemical imbalance in my brain. I just need to find a good psychologist or psychiatrist. That's my problem. Or it's because my parents got divorced. Or whatever the circumstance that any of it, it's universal. And so I'm talking with this guy, and he's helping me kind of get clarity on this, right? And after talking with him and even talking about my experience, I could not identify completely. I wasn't completely sold that I was an alcoholic. So like it was read more about alcoholism, it says, why don't you step over to your nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking? Now, to some people that sounds like a joke, but it's very serious when they said that. They meant that. I think it could be, like I said, it may be worth a bad case of the jitters. That's what this reading says. Like, these readings aren't like, you know, they're directions. Now, that's not for every situation. It depends on the situation, but that can be a very useful tool. It can be very hurtful in my experience to try to keep somebody that's constantly doubting whether they're an alcoholic or not, to try to keep them sober, right? So this guy says, Ryan, when you drink, pay attention to what happens when you drink. Because at this point, I had read the book so many times and been around here enough that I kind of had a good understanding of what the big book was saying. When it came to ideas like powerlessness, right? I didn't have a complete understanding of powerlessness until I saw what the book was saying and connected it to my experience. Now, I could see that, especially after this relapse, so I go back out and I drink, and I wanted to just pay attention and see if I'm really an alcoholic, right? Well, when I drank, I didn't get back into Alcoholics Anonymous this time sober for almost 9 months, right? So what the book talks about is this phenomenon a craving develops, this physical allergy, right? So that's telling me that when I drink alcohol, that there is a natural reaction inside of me that I can't prevent from happening. But my previous time sober, that's as far as I ever went. I was thinking, I just need to make sure that I don't go back to drinking, right? I need to remember what happens. I need to play the tape through. I need to have a picture of, you know, of my face after this situation or whatever. I needed to remember. Or when I feel like drinking, I need to call somebody. And I'm going to read this. And so what this says in page 43, more about alcoholism, it says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So things like a call list and playing the tape through and remembering what happens, they can work. But what this says, at certain times, it won't. So because I wasn't clear on that, I was living this sobriety with the hope and the reliance that I was always going to be able to play the tape through if I really wanted to stay sober. I was always going to be able to call my sponsor or somebody in AA if I really wanted to stay sober. But not understanding that if I'm a real alcoholic, I have another part of what powerlessness means. Now, powerlessness is talking about a physical allergy once I start, but it's also talking about a mental obsession. So what this is describing is, I get drunk when I'm sober. Why is it that we can be sober 3-4 months or a year or 2 years and think that it's okay to drink? Well, this book is filled with information giving us case after case of other members' experience of what happened to them, right? We all know the story of the gentleman that thought it was a bright idea to mix whiskey with milk. That's funny, but our brain, our thinking can work like that, where we think it's just innocent and it'll be fine. And so after this relapse, obviously coming back, I had a whole new experience with what this program was about, because it talks about in here, it says, we had to concede to our innermost self. What I like to share is one of the biggest changes for me was when these beliefs of me being an alcoholic went from my head to my heart. Now, when I concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, I believe it goes from here to here. Now, once it goes to here, and it's a completely different experience, and that's what happened for me. So I'll share this real quick. October of 2008, so I got sober January 2009, so this is in between the last relapse and now, or during the last relapse. October 2008, along with alcohol, I was injecting drugs as well, and I was doing that for about 2 years. And I was desperately trying to find a method to get sober, right? Now, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous 4 times before. I have tried churches, psychologists, psychiatrists, you can name it. I've done it. You were full of crap, which, let me just throw this disclaimer, it's not true at all. But that's what I was running with, right? You guys are the problem. I was hopeless. For the first time in my life, I was hopeless. And I was just trying to find a way that I could kind of maintain and create sobriety. So October of 2008, I ended up getting an abscess in my arm from injecting. And I went to St. Agnes in Fresno. I had to get rushed to the emergency room. They performed immediate emergency surgery. If I was a couple hours later, they would have removed my arm. And so they removed a hole about the size of my fist. It was so bad, my mom said she could see my elbow through my arm from here. So I was quarantined. I was quarantined for the first 6 days. I wasn't allowed to be around anybody. My body rejected all the medication that they gave me. Finally, my body started taking it, accepting the medication, and so I was in the hospital in ICU for 14 days. I was hooked up to a vacuum. I don't know if anybody else here has had this, but I had a tube basically constantly sucking out any bacteria to prevent further infection. And the tube was like a 5-foot tube connected to this battery that was on my hip, right? So I finally get released home, and the next day I'm at my mom, you know, I'm at my mom's house during this process. She needs to help me out and clean me and all that a couple times a day. So I tell her, Mom, I need to go spend time with people from church, right? I'm going to go hang out with my college group. And that very next day I was going back to one of the dealers and having him inject me in the other arm. So when we talk about, this phenomenon of craving or this physical allergy, for me, I had it with alcohol and the drugs. In this situation, talk about the insanity of that, right? It was a miracle that I was even alive, and the very next day, I could not prevent myself from continuing. I didn't get sober until January of 2009, so it was 4 months later. I'll share this real quick because I know I'm about done, but I was thinking about it a little bit yesterday, of, you know, especially with it being 6 years. For the type of person that I am, not being able to stay sober longer than 4 months, you know, through Alcoholics Anonymous, to be sober 6 years is surreal. It's still surreal. 6 years, and it doesn't get old. I mean, this becomes more real, and my life becomes more about God and about truth. And to get to that surrender was so painful. Surrender wasn't like this happy, positive thing that I got to. I was hopeless. I shared this last year, and this is a sermon that I heard on K-Love Christian radio station, and I just happened to be listening to it this one Sunday. And the pastor was talking about the difference between boiling water and water that produces steam. And this is a live recording of him doing a sermon to his congregation. And so he asked the congregation, he says, "What do you think the difference is?" Right? There's this pause, and he says, "The difference is 1 degree." So there's 1 degree difference between boiling water and water that produces steam. And he says, "You know that water that produces steam has the power to move a locomotive?" And all of a sudden, this clarity came to me that my entire life, I've been trying to produce that 1 degree by myself. I was trying to get you to produce that extra degree for myself, motivate me. I realized in that moment that only God could give me that extra degree. But I had no clue of how that was going to work. And for the first time in my life, I didn't believe in myself. I was hopeless. Next thing you know, I wind back up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, of everything that I went through and all the hell that I went through, which I know most of us in here go through hell, we wouldn't be in Alcoholics Anonymous if we didn't. But to come back into Alcoholics Anonymous and have a completely different experience, it was so freeing to not question or doubt whether I was an alcoholic or not. I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I was an alcoholic and that I belonged here. And so what that made possible was I started to listen. I started to take to heart what you guys were talking about. And throughout this whole process, the foundation, the fundamentals of it, on top of me being an alcoholic, is that my sobriety and my livelihood is completely dependent on my relationship with God. That me having 6 years, there's work that I've had to do, a lot of footwork, but me being sober is completely because of God's power. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous is a platform, and what these 12 steps are about, it's a platform, it's a direction of how you can find a connection with a power greater than yourself. Now, if that connection happens, incredible things happen. And I'm going to read this, and then I'm done. I promise. Okay? I'm going to shut up. Right after this. So it's now how it works. It says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Thank you.